This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Nicht warten, durchstarten mit Indeed. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt auf indeed.com/julep. Mit einer Premium-Stellenanzeige wird dein Angebot ganz oben auf der Seite platziert. Für mehr Sichtbarkeit, damit du schneller die richtigen Mitarbeiter findest und einstellen kannst. Und das Beste, das alles funktioniert ohne monatliches Abo oder langfristige Verträge. Du zahlst nur für Ergebnisse. Sicher dir jetzt 75 Euro Guthaben auf eine Premium-Stellenanzeige auf indeed.com/julep. Es gelten die AGB.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Dolan Show!
Well, big, big subjects on the programme this morning. Why have we not got the programme for government as we were promised? What on earth is going on? We delve into that. And paramilitary groups, the IRC, proposing to appoint someone to talk to these paramilitary leaders. Who are still transitioning. Thought we would be here all the time. Transitioning. Is it time for that to be an unacceptable word when we talk about these gangsters? Why, if they're going to transition, what's stopping them doing it? What's credibly stopping them doing it after so many years? Or is it worth putting the time and effort in to pulling them across the line? All coming up on Nolan This Morning.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here in the Nolan Show today. Or will we bring you the Nolan Show? Or just leave silence and delay it until tomorrow? So what is this? A hiccup at the centre of our government where they've promised you their list of priorities? Many, many, many months of no delivery for a programme for government. They then organise that they will share it all with you today and a last minute delay. So what is that? Just a hiccup? Move on to another story? Or is it deeply embarrassing? Is it shining some type of light? How can they plan to announce something so important and then they can't deliver it on the day they say they were going to? 03030 80 55 55. So what is it? As you in your daily lives have a list of things that you've got to do, and if your boss asks you to deliver something by a certain time, and all of that, and this lot up in Stormont. And this is about reduced waiting lists. This is about violence against women and girls. My goodness, someone in Stormont might actually think some of you might be interested in what they're promising to do. Our political editor, our political correspondent, Gareth Gordon, with us this morning. So, just a little hiccup. That's how they're trying to position it, Gareth. Technicality. Or is there something more going on here? Is this a power struggle between Alliance and the other parties?
Well, Stephen, as Ollie said to Stan, it's another fine mess. It's probably all of the things that you say. I am told it's a minor issue. It emerged late last night. Andrew Muir, the Agriculture and Environment Minister, the draft final document was circulated on Friday. There were things in it that he thought needed amended. He didn't see what should have been the final document presented to the executive this morning in time. So very late, and I'm so late last night that I didn't get a call about this until 6 o'clock this morning, when they knew we were reporting that the executive meeting was happening. So it's so last minute that there wasn't time to make these changes, they say. And so they've postponed, probably, although not definitely, and if you've covered Stormont as long as me, it's probably wise to be sceptical, for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. If that happens, we'll move on and forget about this. But at the very least, it's cock-up rather than conspiracy. It's amateur-er, and it looks very bad, and there's no polishing it, really. It does not put the executive in a very good light at all.
Like, we trust these people at a time of crisis to be able to act quickly and professionally. Is it a degree of disregard for the public that they think it doesn't matter when they deliver a programme for government?
Well, it certainly shows a lack of understanding of the basics of PR. I presume if they had thought there was any chance of this happening at all, we would have not been told definitively that the executive was meeting this morning at 10 o'clock. There was to be a news conference at 12 o'clock. That clearly was no problem was in their thinking when we were told that. And as I say, that was the case until this morning. So it's a PR nightmare. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the very fact that this executive four-party coalition managed to agree a programme for government, which was published on the 9th of September, was taken as a sign that this was a new way of doing business, that this was a success story in the making, because, remember, there hasn't been an agreed programme for government operated since 2011 to 2015. There was one agreed in 2016. It went out to public consultation, but Stormont then collapsed, so it was never enacted. So we haven't really had an operational programme for government agreed since 2011, which is not great, let's face it. This one was agreed, a draft was agreed anyway. There is no major issue, I'm told, at all with any of it. This is a carry-on Stormont story as opposed to a Stormont crisis. There's no threat to the executive, I am told, and I don't believe there is. But it looks bad. It looks a little bit amateurish.
It's quite a big statement from you, Gareth, to describe this as amateur or. It's quite a big statement.
Well, it looks a little bit amateurish. Could anybody argue with that, Stephen?
But so what does it say about the capability of these people if there was a crisis?
Well, you've dealt with Stormont in crisis before, you know how it usually goes. I am told this is not a crisis. I do not believe it's a crisis. I'm getting this from multiple sources that it's just a cock-up. But it doesn't look great. And if they had to live their life over again, this time yesterday morning, we didn't know there was going to be definitively an executive on a press conference. So they didn't have to tell us that. So it's somebody, one side's not telling the other what is going on.
And finally, Gareth, you mentioned earlier, if I heard you right, that Andrew Muir needed an amendment. What was he asking for?
Well, he didn't really make that clear on Good Morning Ulster. He feels that he was bounced into this agreeing this document this morning. He hadn't seen the final document and he wouldn't see it until he sat down at around the executive table at 10. Andrew Muir could speak for himself. I don't think there was anything major in it. It was probably the way things were done that he didn't like. But as I say, it doesn't look great. Okay. Stormont will, I think they will agree this programme for government and they'll all move on, but it's not been a great day.
Gareth, thanks very much indeed. 030 30 80 55 55. Jeff in Belfast. Morning, Jeff.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And your 150,000 odd listeners. This is a farce, Stephen. This is an absolute farce. This is going to happen time after time after time between the smaller parties, the Ulster Unionist Alliance and the big two. They're just there to prop up the DUP Sinn Féin coalition. That's where real power lies. This is not the first time it's going to happen. This is not the
Well, you say the real power lies there, but it looks like Muir has stopped them being able to announce this today.
Well, has it?
Is that not power?
But again, it shows the farce of the system. We need to move to voluntary coalition, Stephen. We really, really do. Because, as I said, the Ulster Unionists and the Lands Party, they're there for camouflage. If they had any respect, if the Ulster Unionist and the Lands Party and Andrew Muir himself had any respect for himself and his party, they should withdraw, join the SDLP, and then we would have a real choice in the 2027 Assembly election, either the DUP or Sinn Féin, or an Ulster Unionist Alliance SDLP coalition. Thanks very much, William. Sorry, Stephen.
Sammy in Belfast. Morning, Sammy.
This is not a crisis for Stormont, Stephen. This is an absolute crisis, yet again, for the Northern Ireland public, who go to the polls every couple of years and vote people in who are incapable of delivering. I sincerely, and I don't always agree with Ben Lowry, who recently wrote about cardists of MLAs. They were cards. And the card this morning is, in my opinion, the health minister. When this programme for
somebody at your door.
Out, yes, and the dog has went mad. There's no money. When this programme for government comes out, Stephen, There's no money to do it.
It's not what this is about today. We're getting, there's also, like, I'm sitting here.
I know what's about, Stephen.
I'm sitting here 9:15 this morning, right? So Gareth is reporting that Andrew Muir wanted an amendment. Meanwhile, some within the Alliance Party are saying, look, this is just about getting sight of documents in a timely manner. So what is it? What does Andrew Muir want? Has he got it or not? Simple questions that the public are entitled to know.
Stephen, the best thing that could happen here that would really change politics in this country is if Alliance and the Austrian Unionist Party had the courage to say, we've had enough of this. We're going in the opposition. That the DUP and Sinn Féin...
Well, enough of what? Because if this programme for government, when it is eventually presented to the public, and look, can you trust them? If they say it's presented tomorrow, can you trust them? Might they just say, oh... And you're calling Mike Nesbitt a coward, a man that's taken on a ministerial brief for a department, who could do any better? You tell me what the different idea is.
Somebody who would make decisions to reform.
Well, he's making decisions.
No, he hasn't.
And the other parties decided not to take that ministry.
No, it doesn't matter who takes it. You keep targeting ministers. It's a four-party mandatory coalition, so every decision made around that table is meant to be made by them all. Today proves it isn't. It's made by Sinn Féin, DUP. They should own their mess. Alliance and Austrian Unionist parties should go in the opposition. An electoral masterstroke at the next election will get rid of the problem.
Thank you, Sammy. Good morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. So, has Andrew Muir set out two Good Morning Ulster this morning clearly? What did he want in that paper that he didn't get? Is he going to hold out for it? Is he holding out for nothing? Is this just a technicality? How on earth do you tell the public the announcements today and then this morning? How does that happen? Who's responsible for it? Is this a power struggle where Alliance are rightly or wrongly saying to those big two, you'll treat us properly or you won't get your own way? What's going on? Let's have a listen to Minister Muir speaking to Sarah Brett on Good Morning Ulster this morning.
This really is a storm in the teacup. There is a meeting scheduled for tomorrow at 8 o'clock and I'll be confident, hopefully we can get agreement on the programme for government. The only ask from myself, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable ask, is that the finalised document will be received before the meeting so we could consider it. We need to have a process in place for governance that once the document, obviously I don't know what's been going on for the last period of time in terms of the delay in this, but we've now got the our draft version, and the only ask is that we get the finalised document before the meeting so we can consider it.
Okay, so let's get this straight. We have the draft programme for government. What has changed within it that makes it necessary for everybody to have? I mean, obviously, you've been working on it together for the last X amount of weeks. Are you saying that you haven't seen it at all and in its final form yet?
So the draft programme for government went out for a consultation. Then a period elapsed and really an unnecessary delay, really, in terms of getting a draft finalised programme for government. As part of that, I think it's important as ministers, we see the feedback that was received from stakeholders to the programme for government. People spent a lot of time responding to that. I think it's important to see that. I also want to see the
real... It was a consultation, wasn't it? Are you telling me that you haven't seen any of that yet and yet you were supposed to sign it off today?
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly reasonable. I would see that. I also want to see the rural impact analysis, and I also want to see how the equality considerations around this. You know, you can't expect me to go into a meeting without seeing that information. I mean, the minister is also responsible for rural affairs. So I want to see that information.
So you're saying that you haven't seen it. Who has seen it?
Well, as for others to answer in relation to this, it's important that all the documents.
Minister, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut across you there because we can't be expected to think that nobody's seen this document and it's going to be signed off today. So somebody has. It must be the DUP and Sinn Féin that have seen it.
It's led by the Executive Office, which is the First Minister and Deputy First Minister, and it's for them to bring this forward in terms of the programme for government.
Okay.
All I may ask is that the finalised documentation is sent to ministers in advance of the meeting, and I mean, like, not 15 minutes in advance. We get a proper consideration. Hopefully we'll be able to do that today. We'll be able to look through the documentation and take a considered opinion in relation to this. There's no real showstoppers in relation to this. I would say, being part of a coalition government is difficult. There's many things that we would like to see within this that is not in it. We would like to see institutional reform so we end this cycle of crisis and collapse, and also in terms of government functioning more effectively. We would like to see that in there. I want to see the commitment under New Decade, New Approach, okay, in terms of setting up an independent environmental protection agency. But we just need to get this agreed, we need to move forward, and we need to continue to deliver for the people of Northern Ireland.
So there was nothing specific about farming or nothing specific about your brief. What this was about was that you hadn't got to see it in advance of it being published. Can I just check, has any minister, to your knowledge, seen it?
The issue is the finalised document.
Yes.
Following the feedback that the departments have came back with in terms of recent days, that hasn't been published.
So the draft
finalised document was circulated on Friday afternoon. We were given until yesterday to come back with feedback, and then the meeting was scheduled for this morning at 10 o'clock, and the request was, once that feedback's been received, that the finalised document would be sent in advance of the meeting so we could consider it. And I think that is only reasonable to say that is a request. I would also say, in terms of the draft programme for government, which went out to consultation, I was disappointed, despite the request from my department, for agri-food to be included within it. It wasn't included within it, but it is now included within this updated version. I'm glad to see that, and I'm glad to see the Executive Office included that.
Some people might look at this, Andrew Muir, and see this is a little bit of politicking by Alliance, because you've said it's not specific about your brief necessarily, but it is about the balance of power, isn't it? And does it not show, when we've all been waiting so long for a programme for government, that just to throw it under the bus at the last minute, even if it does happen tomorrow, it creates a big stink and we all report on it, and it gives you the opportunity to play politics. Some people will look at it and say that.
Nothing could be further from the truth. This is about good governance. And I think anyone who understands the request to receive finalised papers in advance of the meeting would understand that as a reasonable request.
Jim Allister would say, for example, that it doesn't show good governance. It shows the exact opposite. It shows chaos. Well, and he called it the Stormont farce.
That's what I'm trying to ensure. Would anyone who's listening to the show go into a meeting and receive a finalised programme for government for agreement as the meeting's potentially starting? Like, seriously? All my request was is that the finalised programme for government, the feedback from people in terms that they sent through to the programme for government, the rural impact analysis and also the equality considerations are sent to us in advance of the meeting. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate request.
That's Minister Muir speaking to Sarah Brett this morning. I'll tell you one of the key things in that interview. So Minister Muir is saying there are no showstoppers here. How do you know, Minister, if you're saying at the same time you haven't had time to see the feedback? So for all of those people that feed back into government and are cynical as to whether any of you pay any attention to it, you've got a government minister now saying he hasn't had time to see the feedback, but there's no showstoppers. How do you know? And you haven't had time yet, Minister Muir, to look at the rural impact, and yet this is going to be delivered tomorrow, is it? All agreed? How do you know? So how does the Alliance Party, why should the Alliance Party not be saying this morning, we don't know if there's going to be a showstopper because we have not seen the feedback? That feedback is from stakeholders, from members of the public, from businesses, from communities. What is going on in Stormont? Mick Fieldy, editor of Slugger O'Toole. This is as clear as mud this morning. Oh, don't worry. We'll deliver it tomorrow. Don't worry, it's not today. And a government minister saying he's been given no time to look at the public feedback. Does that mean these calls for feedback are a farce?
It depends what way you look at it. Look, I have some sympathy with Sarah's line of question there, that this is the Alliance Party trying to create some visibility for itself. But look... The more sympathetic way of looking at Alliance's complaint here is that in the general rule in clubs and societies, not government departments, but clubs and societies, is that you give people at least 7 days' notice before a meeting with the agenda the minutes of the previous meeting, and all the associated papers that they have to examine in advance of that committee meeting. That's 7 days' notice. This guy was given a few hours' notice the day before the meeting was to take place. Now, he's a minister. He's properly elected. His party has a mandate to put him in the executive. But I think this is another case of two parties. And what's the rush? Goodness sake.
He got the finalised draft on Friday, but he didn't get the final paper.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that you wouldn't share the feedback from the public with your own executive ministers. I mean, the executive office is behaving here like the White House, rather than as the senior representatives of the elected executive, i.e. the cabinet. In other words, they're treating cabinet members as people who really don't need to see this thing until the very last minute, and the context, which is important. You know, and after 14 years since the last program for government, you've got to say, like, why are you, what are you afraid of in just sharing a lot of that feedback?
Is this about power, Mick? Is this about, some people get off on power. Is this about, for these smaller parties, you know, you'll get it when we give it to you?
Yeah. We've seen it before. We saw it in that controversial meeting of the committee for the executive office, where the first minister bounced the Alliance Party chair into basically giving her the outcome that she wanted. So I think there's a bit of power here. I think there's a little bit of look, we're the adults. We've made the decision, and I'm sure that hammering out a program for government between two parties as diverse in their political opinions and values as the DUP and Sinn Féin was not an easy gig to pull off. But if you're only going to pay lip service to the power-sharing executive, which is where decisions are actually made and where ministers are expected to take responsibility for their departmental decisions, then you're very quickly going to find that fiction runs out, and your political capital in being able to hold that together also runs out. So there are limits to that power.
Anne Watts with me this morning as well, director of Pivotal, the think tank. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
There's another question here. Someone from deep within the Stormont machine said to me this morning, the bigger question about the programme for government when it's published is, does it actually make any meaningful difference to what departments already do? And they're at the heart of one of the departments. And they said to me, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's a big question. And we have to see the final version of it when it emerges in the next couple of days and start asking those kind of questions about, you know, are there targets in this, saying specifically this is what the executive is going to improve? Does it link the budget to the priorities in the programme for government? Do they make specific commitments rather than just aspiration? What are they going to deliver for people? How can people expect their situation in terms of access to the health service or education or housing or wastewater infrastructure? How can they expect things to be better in 12 months, 24 months, 36 months? And we need to see that kind of detail in the programme for government when it actually emerges. And there is, you know, the person you talked to there, I think is right. There's a lot of scepticism about whether this really makes any difference. But I would say, Stephen, it's really important that we do have a programme for government, because otherwise we don't know anything at all about what the executive is doing and what its priorities are. So this is a step in the right direction.
But in terms of how importantly they take it on,
yeah.
Why would the executive office, so in other words, the DUP and Sinn Féin, it's Michelle O'Neill and Emma Littlekin Pengelly, why would those two parties not want to give... why would the executive office not want to give the other parties within that executive as much time as possible if they're genuinely sitting up there as a collective trying to do the very best job possible for Northern Ireland? Why wouldn't they want to have time for them all to look through the public feedback, the stakeholders, the businesses? My goodness, nurses and doctors might have fed in to some of that feedback. Do they not give a damn? Do they think they know it all? Why are they not sharing it? How come Andrew Muir is saying hasn't seen it, and now he's what, hopefully can agree this at 8 a.m. tomorrow? What, take a day to look through the rural impacts and all of the public feedback? Or is all that feedback a complete scam and it's not taken seriously?
That's really important. I think that more than 3,000 people responded to this consultation. So a huge number of organisations and individuals said what they thought about the programme of government. And, you know, in one way, Stephen, that's really good because it shows people are having a say and contributing.
Or are they being called?
Yes, we do need the executive to consider that properly. And this sounds to me like, to be honest, a mismanaged process that didn't give enough time at the end stages to allow ministers to look at things
properly. So should the Alliance Party be admired for saying no? Now, they're also then saying probably tomorrow, but should they be admired for saying no?
Well, I think, as Mick said, this is not the first time this has happened. The executive is well known for putting papers to ministers very much at the last minute, particularly putting papers to ministers in the smaller parties at the last minute and expecting them to agree. So I think Andrew Muir really he's taken a stand here and he said this is not acceptable. And, you know, the result of that is the whole thing's been delayed. So in some ways, this has shone a light on that practice and stopped something happening. And in terms of it being a genuine four-party coalition, that's maybe a helpful thing to have happened that might challenge the processes and the rushed timings that have happened in the past.
McFieldy, if they do deliver this programme for government tomorrow, and we now know that Minister Muir hasn't had more than, what, a day to look through the public feedback, what does that say? Should it be delayed further?
Look, what it says is that this is not a government that is based on consensus, broad consensus, across four parties. Everything is being done on the basis of consensus just between the two, and whatever scraps fall off the table, that's what the other two parties have to deal with. And I don't think that is sustainable. It is probably one of the reasons why we've had to wait for over a year for the first programme for government in 14 years. And you really have to ask yourself, with all the things that are happening, and Anne's given a good list, I think, around infrastructure, but in health, you know, in Northern Ireland, for any routine orthopaedic operation, you're talking about an 8 years waiting list. Now, you can cut that down to a couple of months if you're prepared to pay for it. But in certain health authority areas in England, that's only 18 weeks. You know, it's not as though these people are an irrelevance to the ordinary lives of people in Northern Ireland. The fact that they're taking so long to do something, which in the Republic took a matter of weeks, it is indicative of a lack of courage, a lack of imagination, and a lack of political commitment to sorting out all these problems. And it doesn't really matter whether you're unionist or nationalist. The only way you're going to convince people of your own ultimate ambition for Northern Ireland's constitutional ambitions, it depends on whether you can deliver good services in the here and now. And I'm afraid these two parties are failing that test.
There's a question just going ding in my mind, and I might be off on the wrong tangent here. But if the executive office didn't deliver those papers to the last minute, according to Andrew Muir, has Mike Nesbitt had time? This is a genuine open question. Health, one of the biggest briefs in the country. Has he had time to look through the feedback? When did he get it? When did the Minister for Health get it?
And everybody will have got it at the same time, Stephen, on Friday.
Muir's saying he didn't see the feedback until when? Yesterday?
I think what he's saying is on Friday they saw a
draft,
full draft of the
final. But then there were changes made.
But then what at that point on Friday, the question was, what does each department think about this? So the civil servants in each department will have been looking at that draft over the weekend and giving their views. So that, you know, views from the Department for Infrastructure, Department of Health, DERA, Department of Finance, all of them will have given their views over the weekend. And then what Andrew Muir was saying he hadn't seen was, what did all departments say? So he wanted to know, what did other ministers think about this? You know, and is it going
to
result
in changes? He went further than that. He said he didn't see rural impact assessments within his brief. He said he didn't see the public feedback. So was Mike Nesbitt given enough time to see impact assessments on health? Was he given enough time to see the public consultation? We'll go to him right now and we'll ask that question. This actually opens it up, making my view beyond Andrew Muir. Those other ministers, the Justice Minister, Naomi Long, how much time were they given to actually assess this?
Well, look, prima facie, we'll have to wait until Mike Nesbitt or Naomi confirm that. But prima facie, absolutely, they were given no time at all. And look, the truth is that if you want the team to play as a team, you've got to treat them with some kind of respect. And kudos, I think, to Andrew Muir for bringing this into the public domain. Too many things that happen in Stormont stay in Stormont, you know, like Las Vegas. It's like all the mistakes can't be put in the public domain. But the truth is, if we don't see the mistakes, they can't be corrected. There is no incentive for the minister, the first or deputy first minister, or any member of the executive to examine the shortcomings of their approach, and therefore we're getting suboptimal politics.
The Nolan Show is also going to be under the executive office right now, asking them why. Why did they deliver this to these ministers so late? Why? Explain yourselves to the public of Northern Ireland. Let's see what they say. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Mick. 0303 80 55 55. Here comes the news from the BBC. Good morning, everyone. 0303 80 55 55. We'll take your calls about this later in the programme. Our next story, the UK and Irish governments are to explore formal engagement with paramilitary groups to help bring about their disbandment. An independent expert will be appointed to assess whether there's merit and support for the idea. The proposal was suggested by the Independent Reporting Commission, which monitors police and government efforts to tackle paramilitarism. So, talking to these groups, talking to these leaders. Are you in support of that or not? 0303 80 55 55. I've been speaking to Monica McWilliams from the IRC. Began by asking Monica what the thinking is behind this.
Well, for 3 years now, we have been recommending that something needed to change. We totally agree with the criminal justice response, which was one of our twin tracks. And the other was obviously preventing young people from being recruited into paramilitaries and all the work that needed to be done around socioeconomic responses. I mean, that is really a systemic issue, educational disadvantage, deprived areas, etc. We know all that. But the third piece that we've added to that 3 years ago, and now finally it will be taken forward, was that an independent expert should be appointed to scope out and explore with the groups themselves the potential to engage in a process for transition. We've recommended group transition for some time now. We've had individuals transition. We've had communities transition, and that's good. But we have not tackled the issue of group transition. And 10 years after Fresh Start, when our commission was set up, we recommend that something different now has to happen. Doing the same old thing isn't going to lead to a different outcome. And that's the outcome that we would like to see, is group transition.
The Secretary of State has insisted, he's claiming that these people aren't going to be bought off. But what's to incentivise them to go away now if they haven't gone away up to now? They're knee-deep in criminality, these people.
Well, criminality and overt criminality we know about, and that is being tackled by one of the recommendations that we made through the Paramilitary Crime Task Force. And indeed, they've recovered over 5.6 million in assets, which is the way to go after them. But here's the issue. I mean, there won't be financial inducements. It needs to be an engagement about a process. And what would that process look like from their point of view? They're going to be the people who are going to transition. It won't be imposed on them. And to date, they've been saying that no one has engaged with them about where they want to go next. So it's about changing the narrative in terms of what we did all those years ago when we were reaching the peace agreement about either getting into politics or doing good work in the community. and moving away and putting clear blue water between those that are the gangsters and the criminals.
Do you agree with them that no one's engaged with them properly?
That's correct, because they are proscribed organisations. We, under the Commission, have been able to do that, but it does need this new person to come in, have authority, have the powers that we did not have, which is assessment powers, to see exactly who's doing what at the granular level. Nobody should be blindsided in the future. It's really important that we have the security services and the intelligence. But the best intelligence also comes from the community. There will be stakeholders involved that includes the community. And
includes
that's really
the gangsters,
important.
Monica.
Well,
some of the stakeholders will be these criminals.
And then the police need to be able to say and give that assessment. Here are the folks that aren't going to move, and there's no point in engaging with those. And here are the ones who have been telling us and telling others that they do want to transition. There may be a difference between the urban and rural areas. We need to map all that out in terms of who's directing who, and are there groups, which we know, because we have been around it in Northern Ireland, who are saying, we want to get off this scene. And now's our opportunity, because there's no other alternative. They're stuck. Completely stuck. And these are not the gangsters and the criminals, because we know who those people are, and the police have a big job in tackling that, which they're doing, and have actually been able to do things in the past year that they weren't able to do before. But organised crime legislation, Stephen, needs to be introduced. And if the Minister of Justice is cross about this particular appointment, then she needs to move, you know, and bringing in that organised crime legislation, which Northern Ireland does not have, and other parts of the UK does.
But when your organisation is interacting with those people in prescribed organisations, what will you be asking them or saying to them beyond they shouldn't be here already? So what will you be asking them or offering them?
Well, we've set out a criteria for what group transition looks like. It would be no further recruitment, standing down the structures, dealing with existing weaponry, the allowing people to exit without consequences, indeed even engaging with the legacy bodies. We have about 7 criteria that we've set out in our previous reports. Now, that will be up to the independent expert to deal face-to-face with the leadership. And we need to hear that they're prepared to engage. And that's all that will be the next stage. It won't be the actual process itself. It will lay out in 12 months' time exactly what the steps will be.
Allowing people...
If it's a reverse gear, which you seem to be suggesting may happen, then that will be the case.
No, what some of my questions are about is that law-abiding people, some of them, and look, Northern Ireland's a complicated place, I get that, but some law-abiding people are sick to death of these people talking for years about so-called transitioning. It's a stalling tactic. They've no intention of transitioning because it's too much. There's too much money in it for them. And they get away with saying year after year, oh, we've got every intention to transition. And they don't mean it. That's what I'm trying to convey in some of my questions.
Well, I've heard that on your programme over and over again, and I can absolutely understand that because we've also been dealing with that. On the other side of the fence, there are those who say, we need to move. But there hasn't been a process in place. There was, actually, after the agreement in terms of probably the Provisional IRA, looked at it and said, right, there is a peace process, there's a political process. Moving into the political process was an option, and clearly still is an option for some of those groups on the ground. And we're not talking about those engaged in gangsterism and criminality. There will always be people who will profiteer in societies. But the difference between us, the Republic of Ireland and the UK have gangs and gangsters. The allegiance to those paramilitaries is what makes a difference here in Northern Ireland, and that has to be understood. So the approach taken elsewhere will not work here, and we need to take a different approach.
And final question, would there be is this their last chance of engaging with these people? It gives them a certain status even engaging with them in the first place.
Well, I hear that argument, that it gives them a legitimacy. And that would have been the same argument 26 years ago at the time of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. This is not about giving people legitimacy. This is about engaging and exploring with them what they will, steps they will be taking. And as I said, it's a scoping and exploration exercise by this expert, providing a good analysis based on good intelligence and providing us, the IRC, with a report that says, yes, here are the groups that are ready to move or reverse gear. They're stuck. They're not going anywhere. End of story. So that's the whole point of having this person in place. As we did in the past, we had international individuals come to Northern Ireland and down in the balcony. This is a kind of final piece of the process, of the peace process. It's the unfinished business, and it very much needs to be done.
Monica, thanks for talking to me this morning. Thanks very much indeed. We'll hear from Saoirse Eastwood from the Lions Party in a moment or two. Declan's in Carrickfergus. Morning, Declan.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I'm listening to this lady and I'm absolutely baffled. This scam has been going on for years about talking to the paramilitaries and trying to get them to transition. They've been handed jobs, they've been handed money, hand over fist by the both governments, and nothing has changed. They're still tormenting their own communities. So I'm baffled by this girl saying that this needs
she's
to
not
start
a girl, is she?
These people.
Her name's
I'm baffled that she is saying this hasn't happened already, because the millions that's been poured into these paramilitary groups is absolutely frightening.
Look, I said it.
Frightening. And sorry, Stephen, one more. Good community groups within both sides of the community can't get money because these paramilitaries get control of it.
Hold on. There's plenty of time here. Don't worry. It's whether you believe the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, or not. He has said...
I don't believe any of them, Stephen.
Well, he has said that this is not the start of a formal process, and he wants to make clear no financial offer will be made to paramilitary groups or the individuals involved in them in exchange for an end to violence and ongoing harms.
Stephen, they're getting money hand over fist. Hand over fist, millions, which is being drained into their own communities and put into their own pockets. And that's a fact. You know it, Stephen, you know it. There's paramilitaries who are community workers by day and paramilitaries by night.
Well,
getting community jobs, well-paid community jobs, and there's other good people within the community can't get the jobs,
look, Declan,
within their own community.
Declan, what you're saying is...
No, sorry, what I am saying is this girl, Monica, this lady, Monica, is absolutely... She's blinded. Blinded by I don't know what, but how she doesn't know this isn't happening before, which she does do, because she's been involved.
Well, I think she said she knows the real world, but they're exploring the possibilities
exploring
of being able to talk these people out of doing
talking.
What they're doing. Can I just give a more rounded picture, Declan? If you Google the Paramilitary Crime Task Force within the PSNI, you will see. Now, whether they're doing enough or not, another question. But you will see where the PSNI have pursued some of these paramilitary criminals. There's a whole department set up for it. And actually how the courts have seized some assets, right? From
them. Stephen, they just go out and get more money.
Well, look, here's... I said
just go out and do it again. What are you talking about?
I said it at the top of the show, and I'll say it again. Are we to believe in Northern Ireland? There's not one police officer, one judge, one journalist in Northern Ireland worth their salt.
Stephen,
hold on, let me finish.
Sorry, go ahead.
That doesn't know who the leaders of these paramilitary groups are, right? Everybody knows who they are. How come they're not taken out? How come?
Stephen, a lot of them are working for the government and government community worker jobs, so... I don't know what you're talking about now.
We've been speaking about this. I'm talking about how come they're not lifted. We've been talking to Lance MP, Saoirse Eastwood. Here's her reaction.
I think really this is now past ridiculous. The vast majority of people out there in the street today are going to be looking in light of everything we've just spoken about in terms of the programme for government, in terms of, you know, budgetary constraints and everything else. It's just disgusting, really, that this is back on the table again. You know, I'm not seeing any appetite from the public for this. I'm not seeing any appetite within political parties for this. So really, you know, I'm asking myself, why have the UK and Irish governments done this?
Well, the reality is these groups continue to function, continue to be up to their necks in criminality. So the alternative, is that better, sit back and do nothing more to try to get them to go away?
No, the alternative is lift them. Lift them.
Well, it's not working, is it? They're not being lifted in enough numbers.
Here's the thing. You know, you're saying it's not working. Actually, Naomi is Justice Minister, and people working within the justice system have been doing really, really important, credible work over the last number of years, and people before that in terms of, you know, the last decades of trying to get people to support this. People have. We've got the Paramilitary Crime Task Force. That isn't just the remit of justice as well. You've also got executive programmes that the entire executive are working in terms of ending the harm, in terms of, you know, drawing attention, trying to get resource, putting the message out there to communities across Northern Ireland. Paramilitary crime gangs, people that are operating in terms of extorting businesses, prostituting children and women, they will be lifted and they will be taken out of communities because they're not wanted. They never were wanted. And people have been getting on with that really, really important work. So whenever the UK and Irish governments barrel in with this suggestion, it's actually in some ways taken away from the positive work that has been going on.
So you're calling on the police to lift who? The leaders of these organisations?
People are being arrested and lifted.
So should the leaders have been around? Their house, you know, people know who they are. Communities know who they are. They continue to exert pressure on local communities. And the leaders of these organisations, be it the UVF, be it any of the others, you know, they're not being lifted. And there's this,
and that's even more reason why we should be focused on the job at hand, the task at hand that we have, where we are working together as an executive in Northern Ireland to tackle these issues, to tackle these people. The last thing we need, Stephen, is a proposal like this on the table that suggests that these people should be taken in by the hand, taken in for a cup of tea and a sit-down and a chat. I mean, people don't want that. They are sick to the back teeth of this. As I say, I'm not getting any public support for this. I'm not getting any political support for this. This is not wanted. And actually, the only alternative is getting these people arrested, taken out of communities, and let the criminal justice system and justice organisations do their work.
Okay. Saoirse, thanks very much indeed. Thank you. You're calling us on this. We'll make some room after 10, 030-30-80-55-55. Dr. Aaron Edwards is author and expert on peace building. Good morning to you, Aaron.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, look, Aaron, if we are to believe the Secretary of State that no money will find its way to these gangsters to get them to stand down, then what could possibly be said to them to convince them to give up their loots of gold?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Stephen. To be honest, they've been around that long. I mean, we're talking well over 50 years now in some cases that they are part of the furniture, unfortunately. And really, you know, in some cases, they are involved in lucrative income streams that really no amount of money, whether it's a few hundred thousand here for a community group or there, will incentivize them. So we need to work out, you know, what other levers can be pulled in order to bring them, you know, off the stage, as Monica McWilliams was talking about with you earlier.
But I'm trying to understand, when this independent expert is appointed, what they could possibly, what's their leverage? What could they possibly say to these people?
Well, I think sunlight is a good disinfectant. I think we need to know exactly what these groups are doing. We hear very general terms, you know, that the UVF's involved in loan shark activity or pressurizing drug dealers into giving them a backhander so they can play their trade in local areas around the Shankill and so on. I think we need to know exactly what these groups are doing. I think that transparency is really what's needed, and that these groups need to justify, the leadership of these groups need to justify why it is that they're still hanging around and living off the back of deprived and marginalised communities such as they are. So I think that an independent expert really needs to do a very critical appraisal of exactly what these groups are doing and hear from victims of these groups.
Should it include the Army Council, what they are or are not doing?
Well, I mean, you've had this discussion on the show before, and I mean, the Provisional Army Council still exists, but we're led to believe that it's a bit of a talking shop, just directing.
Led to believe?
Well, we're led to believe that, you know, it's something that's not of consideration, that really the priority is with loyalist paramilitaries. I find that hard to believe, but I think that, well, that John McBurney has said that there are 12 paramilitary groups out there, and they're all in various stages of transition. I think we need to know exactly, you know, what they're doing. And the Provisional Army Council, it would form part of that in my mind.
And you're saying here, Aaron, that, you know, you're curious as to what the Army Council are or not doing. You know, is there enough curiosity from the media as to what the Army Council are or are not doing? And then we talk about these other groups as well. In other words, is it not nearly taken as a shrug of the shoulders now? We know that these groups are collecting protection money, intimidating people involved in criminality and drugs and all that goes with it. There's not a momentum in society to drive them out because people don't know what to do.
Well, I think that the IRC has come up with this sort of template of a whole of society approach, a whole of government approach, but a whole of society approach is something that's needed to root them out. And that means to stand up against these gatekeepers who are operating under the guise of, we heard one of your callers there from Carrickfergus talking about, you know, community workers paid by day, paramilitaries by night. You know, we need to root that out. That needs to stop, because that sort of stature that we're emboldening these people and we're giving them a legitimacy, as you've said yourself on the show this morning, and that needs to stop. We need to know who these people are.
To the police?
Well, I would say that the police do have to talk to the paramilitaries on an operational basis. Of course, we know that because it's been covered, including by your show before.
Do you hold out any hope that this could affect real change?
I would like to think that it would. I'd like to think that the IRC recommendations are taken seriously, but regarding a scoping study about whether or not a dialogue process should be started, that's an open question. That's for politicians to decide.
Okay. Aaron, thanks very much for coming on this morning. Dr. Aaron Edwards, expert on peace building. You're the experts I want to hear from this morning about these two big stories we're covering. 030 30 80 55 55. We're back straight after the news at 10 o'clock, which is coming up right now. Good morning. So a lot being discussed in the first 60 minutes of the show. We're going to get your calls on air very shortly indeed. Big box office topics. The executive not delivering as they promised they would, their programme for government today. Andrew Muir revealing that he hasn't had time to look at the public feedback, and yet he might sign off on this tomorrow. And we've currently got questions in to other government ministers, including the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt. If Muir wasn't given any degree of time, does Mike think that he can get across all that public consultation and agree to sign off on this tomorrow? Those questions are in. Then the paramilitary, should we be talking to them even more to try to get them to stand down, or should there be an absolute zero tolerance increase approach from the PSNI? And then our third story this morning, the Health Minister Mike Nesbitt has said that the vast majority of people are prepared to travel for healthcare if they're going to get to an area of specialism for what they need. Consultation, which began in October, closes on Friday, has been gauging public opinion on plans for a new hospital network, equal access to healthcare across Northern Ireland, and ensuring services are convenient for older people are among public concerns for the plans. Let's have a listen to what Mike Nesbitt told BBC News about the proposals.
What we need to do is encourage the population to stop thinking about hospitals in isolation. And I'm guilty of that. I think of the Ulster, which I live nearby, as the health service. But sometimes I need I have a heart condition, I have to travel to another hospital because that's where the specialism is. We need to start thinking about hospitals as a network. We need to start recognising that not every hospital will offer every procedure. And look, if you need something and your local facility does it once a week, but 30 or 40 miles away they do it 10 times a day, 5 days a week, which one are you going to go to? We're going to have areas of specialism. Once we establish the principle that it's going to be a network, then we'll move on to talk about specific services like neurology, like stroke, where it's going to be, where the areas of specialism are going to be.
Well, Professor Mark Taylor is from the Northern Ireland Confederation for Health and Social Care. Do you think, Mark, the public will understand and buy into this?
Good morning, Stephen. Well, that is certainly the hope, and I think it's really important, and thank you for having me on, that we do continue to have transparency and openness with our public to assure them that this is not about closure of buildings. Actually, going right back to Bengoa and before, we know that prevention is better than cure, that we want to keep as much care for those elderly populations as close to home as possible. But at the same time, Stephen, we have the mix of knowing that there are specialisations now that require high volume numbers coming through to give the best outcomes. And that is the difficulty we currently have.
Why?
Well, it's very simple, Stephen, and we thankfully within the Review of General Surgery and in many platforms across the NICON stakeholders, we know that when you have the expert dealing with you in the right place, you get a better outcome. Now, what that means, for example, in general surgery, and we hear an awful lot of anxiety about general surgery, that really means abdominal surgery, Stephen. If you have a surgeon who deals with the colon rather than a general surgeon, you're not going to have a stoma. If you have a trauma and your spleen is potentially via or may need to come out, if you're transferred to the centre where we can watch you very closely with critical care, with interventional radiology, those are x-ray doctors that can stop that bleeding, that young person, their spleen is saved. So that is the fact of life. Now, Stephen, you know that if you have a heart attack in Northern Ireland as we sit, no matter where you are, you will only be stented in Elton & Galvin or the Royal Victoria Hospital. And that is because they're high volume centres and it's all about survival. It's all about the best outcome. None of this is about disadvantaging people. And I have the greatest sympathy for our rural communities. But what I would say to all of our public is this: the people of Baleek deserve the same high quality specialist care as the people of Balmoral. And that's what we're trying to do within these frameworks.
Did I hear you right? So when you talked about that surgery where, dependent on who you get, you will or will not be left with a stoma. And a stoma is a bag, isn't it, that sits on the outside of your body. So is it currently the case in Northern Ireland that if you get a general surgeon, you could do without that bag, but you'll end up with one. But if you get a specialist, you won't. Is that what you were saying? Did I hear that right?
You absolutely heard it right. But thankfully, we have moved on in general surgery in Northern Ireland. And that's one of the moves in terms of why we have emergency general surgical centres. But this is the very reason.
So that's not happening anymore.
It's not happening anymore. But it is the reason there was change throughout the United Kingdom, Stephen. I'm a surgeon that deals with the upper abdomen. And I know this is really difficult for listeners because subspecialisation has come throughout the UK, and many would say, well, why don't we go back to the good old general surgeon that fixed your hip, opened your chest, opened your abdomen? Unfortunately, times have moved on, but I don't touch the colon anymore in my emergency practice. That's because I am so specialised in the gallbladder and the upper abdomen, and my colleagues that are specialised in the colon are more likely to join that up again. But Stephen, that's us down a sort of a very niche part of
general
surgery.
I don't think it is, because I think for us all to understand this, I think what you're saying is, do you want to go to the most experienced, the very best person we have in Northern Ireland for your specific surgery? Or do you want to go to someone general? Like ask an electrician. Here, you wouldn't mind doing a bit of plumbing when you're out in the house.
And could I add to that, Stephen, do you want to have your emergency laparotomy done in a centre that's doing 2 to 5 of those per week, or do you want it done in a centre that's doing 10 of them per day? Those are the discussions that we've been trying to have. But here's the real gem in all of this. Southwest Acute Hospital, Daisy Hill, Causeway, Mater Hospital, Belfast are going to become even busier going forward. And I was down in Southwest Acute and Daisy Hill on Friday, and our theatre teams have never been busier because, Stephen, they're doing the elective surgery that causes our waiting lists, and our waiting lists cause our busy ED departments, and our busy ED departments cause the bed blockages and the difficulties of social care, all in the mix. But that's why this framework documentation is so important.
Now,
let's have that public debate, and I appreciate you having it.
Well, let's have it. Let's have some of it, some of the discussion with you this morning. First of all, we are constantly told within medicine that the quicker, especially for illnesses like a stroke, I'm guessing a heart attack and blood clots and all that happens, that the speed with which you report to the authorities, the speed with which you get into hospital can be the difference from long-term impact if we're talking about stroke and not. So how can you justify asking someone from a rural community to eat up more time getting to a hospital because their local hospital has been closed down for those type of major incidents? How are those people not at a disadvantage?
Very good question, Stephen. And the answer is it's not only about speed, it's about outcome. So we now live in a world where if you have a stroke and it's due to a clot in your brain, if you are immediately transferred to the Royal Victoria Hospital, that clot's extracted. And here is the outcome, Stephen. You walk out of hospital. You walk out of hospital. If you, in the traditional past, before interventional radiology, you had a stroke, you went weak down one side and you had a permanent disability. So local stroke management does not give you the ability to walk out of hospital.
But Mark,
that's the stark reality.
The government messaging in I think it's FAST, isn't it? It talks about speed and time. The government
Absolutely.
Messaging has drilled into us. It's about getting to hospital as quickly as possible. Well,
listen, don't mistake me saying the outcome. Time is of the essence, and don't forget, Stephen, in every part of Northern Ireland today and will continue, emergency departments are there. So if you have signs and symptoms of a stroke, you go to your nearest
emergency
department.
They'll not be there if the hospital's closed down or the speciality within the hospital's closed down.
Yeah. So here's I sit in the Nikon group and we talk about this repeatedly, and also with my work in the Department of Health. No hospital that we currently have will be closing. And the important thing about that, Stephen, is there are still emergency departments, and they're fully staffed emergency departments. And this network is nothing new, because let me give you an example. If you have multiple trauma anywhere in Northern Ireland, you fall off a tractor in Newry, you come into the local ED department, there is what's called call and send. One simple call to Belfast, the trauma team is mobilised for all those injuries. You're sent up to Belfast, you have the resuscitation, you have the definitive treatment, you go home. That's been happening because of what we call a trauma network. So the emergency departments are still that vital link. Time is of the essence. You know, if you took a chest pain today in Portstewart, you will go to Causeway Hospital. They will then say, goodness, that's a heart attack that needs a stent. You'll be sent immediately to Altna Galvin. That's called a network.
Well, will you be sent immediately? Like, what? All I hear about are waiting lists and lack of availability for services, the pressure on the NHS. This is sounding different to what I'm hearing on the ground. To the extent where I know of people in my own life, who have had, you know, very serious tumours, and they're on long waiting lists to even get a follow-up scan.
Absolutely,
in Northern Ireland.
Stephen, and I've been on your programme many times talking about the burning platform. And if we go right back to Bengoa, the reason we're having this conversation today, and I'm going to put it in a quote, nothing is more expensive than a missed opportunity. Stephen, the burden of our health service today, whether it be at primary care, social care, waiting lists, the pressures of EDs, the pressures of NIAS, is because we have not embraced change. We have not moved to a more population-based healthcare system. We are making progress. The electronic healthcare record will iron out many of the inconsistencies across the hospital networks that we currently have. But Stephen, a lot of our population are growing older and older with comorbidities. And one of the areas we need to be looking at, and it's happening throughout Northern Ireland, is hospital at home. So is it right that that frail 93-year-old person is in the back of an ambulance for 10 hours and then put in a trolley and sit for 2 days? The answer is no. What are we doing to try and keep that person
in their nursing
home or
their
care home?
You cannot, Mark, tell me that if your plan is implemented, that will stop, because it won't.
Well, what I would tell you, Stephen, is if we continue to implement the necessary changes for our 1.9 million of a population, that's a trust in England, Stephen, you know that, our 1.9 million population, if we try to change the balance and not constantly have it's all about buildings, we spend lots of time talking about buildings, and buildings are only one small part of the delivery of health and social care. Of course, there's no magic wand, and I've been doing this for 10 years now, and I would love to be on your programme saying, isn't it great we have no more waiting lists? But I can tell you one thing, we're doing much more capacity of surgery now than we ever did. You weren't quoting cancellations of surgery during the winter period because we have these surgical hubs now. That's only one small fraction of the multiple aspects of change that we can bring. But we do need our population with us. And it's not their fault that they feel anxious about closure or about withdrawal of services. That's why people like myself and other people want to come on and say, look, you know, I go and work in Southwest Acute Hospital. I'm going to work in Daisy Hill soon. That these are rich environments, and they're actually part of the solution, not the problem.
Are consultants doing too much private work?
So consultants do private work in their own time, Stephen.
Well, you say in their own time. They could choose in their own time to do overtime for the NHS, couldn't they?
Well, absolutely, they
so
can.
So they're doing too much.
Many do. And many do do that, Stephen, but the difficulty here is that many are choosing to do that full stop. So many of our clinicians are deciding they cannot deliver the standard and quality of care that they want to deliver, so they're going full-time private and leaving the NHS, and that, to me, is a travesty.
It's about the standard of care, is it? Or is it about the dosh, Mike? Mark.
Well, they would suggest that it's about all things. It's about efficiency, productivity, delivering the best quality of care as possible. And yes, of course, they're making more money, Stephen.
See, if the public is to buy into this, there needs to be the totality of a conversation. This is not just about the public buying into understanding that specialist areas will give you a better outcome. The public are entitled to ask, well, these specialist surgeons, will they dedicate their lives to the NHS? How much time are they going to be spending in the private sector so that people that do not have the money mm-hmm. are excluded? So what service are the people that this program represents? We represent everybody, but we often focus, we never forget that people do not, not everybody has money.
Absolutely.
So where is this balance going to be struck with these centres of specialism? Yeah. Will those surgeons be, what percentage of their time will they be giving to those centres of specialism against walking across the road to a private hospital and working there?
Well, firstly, you're absolutely right, Stephen, that we have a two-tier system, and that is those who have to rely on the NHS waiting lists have to rely on the NHS waiting lists. The work that is happening at the minute about centres of surgical activity, maximising those surgical activity hubs, is to reduce and to take away the reliance on waiting lists, so that no matter who you are, no matter what, and back to Bevan, you know, money should not be the source of stumbling.
And yet it
is. At the time of you most need, and at the present time it is. But Stephen, there are many competing factors. Sláinte Care are offering consultants an infinitely larger amount of money to go and work there than in Northern Ireland. And similarly, what we want is, you're absolutely right, we don't want a situation where those that have can get and those who cannot or have not the means can't. And that's the reason
for
bringing about the changes that are afoot here.
Sorry to cross you, Mark. My question, my question though is there a commitment? Is there a cap or on how much time these surgeons will be allowed to work elsewhere? Is there a commitment from them of a minimum hours that they will do in these specialist centres, so that the public know that the NHS PLC in Northern Ireland is really serious about free care for everybody if they need it as much as possible? So are the surgeons putting their commitment up front and centre? Are you? You're a surgeon.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So are you, Stephen, committed to you? I'm not trying to personalise this, but I think it's a fair question, Mark.
No, it's a fair question. So we all work a job plan, and I work my job plan in the NHS and beyond. So I, in order to encourage and to show my colleagues that, look, going to the Southwest Acute Hospital is an amazing environment, and it's a wonderful staff, and I pay tribute to them every day because they are outstanding. So within the job plan that any consultant has,
how many hours a week have is that?
Well, it's basically PAs is one programmed activity, which is 4 hours. And most consultants are working between 12 and 13 PAs. That includes their direct clinical time.
What's a PA?
A PA is a programmed activity.
Okay.
So that's a programmed activity of 4 hours. And Stephen, it's very simple. All clinicians in Northern Ireland, and this is a GMC offence if it doesn't happen, all clinicians in Northern Ireland must work their job plan, and then what they do at night, what you do on Radio 5 live at the weekend is your business. What you do in outside contracting is your business outside your working hours. But if you were doing that during your BBC Good Morning or Nolan show, your bosses would have something to say about it.
But
that's exactly the same in the health service, Stephen. So none of these consultants who are going to the independent sector are doing that when they are contracted to be in the National Health Service. And if they were doing that, that's a GMC offence.
So just one final question. You're telling me that you're not aware in Northern Ireland of people that who go to their doctor, they're then passed on to a consultant, and a consultant, the same consultant, tells them, you'll be on a 12 to 24-hour waiting time. By the way, you want to go private? See you in a few weeks' time. You're telling me that doesn't happen?
Well, I can't comment, Stephen, on individual consultant practice. All I would say is that I think it's a very dangerous practice to be contaminating your NHS practice and private practice and swapping between the two. I think that's a very perilous situation.
I've really appreciated the conversation today, Mark, and thank you for spending so much time with us. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome, Stephen. Thank
you. Professor Mark Taylor. Eddie Curtis is from SOS Daisy Hill Committee. Morning to you, Eddie.
Good morning, Stephen. Thank you for having me on.
Well, and look, you've got these people, Eddie, who are trained in saving lives. They're dedicating their lives to saving lives, and they're telling us there will be a better outcome if we embrace this notion of specialist centres.
Stephen, let's make it very clear from the start. SOS Daisy Hill Committee are not against rationalisation. We understand that there is a need for change. The problem that we have is with emergency surgery and emergency activities. For example, there was the removal of stroke services out of Daisy Hill. And if you ring an ambulance, if you can get an ambulance, Stephen, and you live in Annalong, and you have to travel past Daisy Hill to go to Craigavon. That will be approximately 1.5 hours. As you know, there is the famous statement of the golden hour, and every stroke should be treated, hopefully, within that hour. Every minute after that, your chances of survival diminish by 2%. The question has to be asked is why stroke services and emergency surgery was moved out of Daisy Hill. For example, if you live in Craigavon, you've 20 minutes to the Royal. If you live in Annalong, Kilkeel, Cross, Midland, etc., well, the travel times are incredible. The roads are not good. The infrastructure is not there. So therefore, we are not getting an equal service, and the people of our area are very aggrieved
about
that.
But what these doctors are telling you is that if you travel, yes, you may be travelling further, but your outcomes and your chances of survival will be better if you're in a specialist centre. So in other words, they are saying, they're telling you that the longer travel time is trumped by getting the very best surgeon with all of that, those specialists with them. They're doing it every day. They know what they're doing. They're experienced people rather than a general surgeon in another hospital.
Well, Mark was very good at the example that he gave. If you took a stroke, you had to go to the Royal. If you had a clot, that's a very minor number of people that suffer that. The majority suffer a clot that regards a lysis injection. You can get that lysis injection at Daisy Hill, but if you were in Annalong, they will bypass Daisy Hill and take you to Craigavon. And to go back to the point I made at the start, there is a golden hour, Stephen. Would you like a member of your family to take an extra half hour on a travel, which could have a very negative impact on their outcomes?
Helen Hamill listening this morning as well, CFR Acute Services Group, campaigning for services at the South West Acute Hospital in Fermanagh. Helen, your reaction to what you've heard from Professor Taylor this morning?
I think Mark was quite disingenuous to imply that people in a rural population like ours, you know, need to dull down the anxiety and there is better care elsewhere, because frankly, we don't have hours to get to extra good care. So basically, it would be the same as asking you, Stephen, to stick somebody with a ruptured appendix in the back of your Jeep and to drive down to Swah. You will have arrived there quicker than a person in anywhere from Belfast to Swah, as a person will get from Baleek to Altnagelvin. And basically, he's talking about elective procedures. He's talking about 9-to-5 waiting lists for gallbladders and hernias and so on. It's what Deirdre Heenan stated yesterday, which is really important. She said it's about the people in the rural areas who find themselves in an emergency situation in the middle of the night. Will they get to an A&E and get surgery? Will they die immediately on their way to hospital? And I've travelled behind a minibus, which was not paramedic-led, 2 weeks ago, to bring my son, who had an appendicitis, from Enniskillen to Altnagelvin. And I have read so much of the material here that I do feel that while the doctors wear the white coats, the experts also have the experience and the data. And you can't change our geography. Time means deterioration. Deterioration ends up with death.
So who is going to be in?
Mark Taylor quoted that. So well, Mark quoted that on the...
But Helen, when you get... Politics. Helen, yes. when you get to the hospital in your local area...
Yes.
Who is doing your surgery?
There's no surgery. Stephen, I could take a whole programme and tell you the truth. There is no surgery being done.
But who do you want to do your
hospital.
Surgery, is my point.
We need a consultant surgeon who actually.
But if they don't exist, if you cannot have
Stephen,
the, if there aren't enough.
No, Stephen, they haven't advertised for a consultant surgeon since 2021. So that's a myth that you're hearing. All of these are one-sided narratives, and it does get people very angry. But I can tell you factually, they haven't advertised for anybody based at Swah since 2021. So you go in there, you take your chances, you do degenerate, you wait for an ambulance. In our case recently, it wasn't an ambulance, it was a minibus. So you are taking your life in your hands, going up a B road all the way to Altnagelvin. And that is what is expected.
Helen, thank you.
83,000 of us.
Thank you very much, Helen and Eddie. Thank you for talking to us today. Nolan Live's on BBC One at 10:40 tonight, so I'll see you on the television tonight and, of course, the iPlayer. And we'll see you back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Connor's coming up right now.
biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.